This is a production of Cornell University.
Competition, predation, and mutualism are the three main types of biotic interactions between individuals of different species. All three exert powerful selection pressures that shape communities. However, the true importance of interspecific competition in nature remains a controversial and unresolved question. During a Chats in the Stacks book talk at Mann Library, Dr. Andre Daunt discussed his new book, Interspecific Competition in Birds, which highlights the impact of both past and ongoing interspecific competition on the coexistence of species. The lessons learned are timely. As ecologists work to understand the many factors that influence global biodiversity and to model the effects of climate change on populations, they may learn a great deal about species interactions from our feathered competitors.
Before I start, let me first say a few nice things about the place in which we are, Mann Library. You heard it, I come from Belgium. When I wanted a paper that I needed to read, I would fill in a interlibrary loan form, and 6 weeks later I would receive a photocopy. Today, I simply turn on my computer, go to the Mann Library website, and download the PDF. Makes a big difference, I must say. I don't know how people wrote books in the past without that facility, but people did, actually. So what I want to do today is two things, and they will be intertwined. I want to talk about how the book was written, why the book was written, and then also clearly in that context I will say a little bit about what's in the book and some what the conclusions are. So the book started to some extent by accident. In 1998, I was at the IOC, the International Ornithological Conference in South Africa, which is a big conference which happens every 4 years. And I gave a plenary lecture about my work on competition in tits there. And after the talk, John Krebs came to me and he said, Andre, have you ever thought about writing a book about this? I said, no. He said, if I were to write a book, it would be about interspecific competition. So John, of course, being who he is, contacted the science editor of Princeton University Press, which came to my office at Sapsucker Woods and saying, hey, you know, John Krebs said that you might want to write a book about this. Maybe we should talk about that. I said, yes, maybe. So a couple of years later, I had a sabbatical leave coming along, and I said, okay, maybe I'll try to see if I can write a book at all. So I contacted the guy from Princeton University Press again. I said, you know, are you interested? I'm going to try to do this. He said, well, we no longer do this kind of book. Okay. So I went on sabbatical leave to Fort Collins with John Weens, and one semester, and the intent there was to see if I could write a book, meaning could I construct a table of contents. Therefore, I had to read what was published, and basically what I did for a month or two, I read 50 years of literature in a month or two to get to know what was there and think about it, see how I could structure it. And when I left after the end of the semester, I had written not only a table of contents, but half a book. I was very pleased with myself, but I came back to lab ornithology, and at that time I was very much involved, I still am actually, with the long-term studies of disease in house finches, and I had no time at all to think about the book for several years. Then my next sabbatic came along, and I said, okay, now I'm going to take a full year and see if I can finish the book. And so where can you go for a full year? Well, I decided Southern France is not a bad idea. So I went to Montpellier, which is here over there in Southern France. And you know, it's not a bad idea. It's a beautiful part of the world, lots of medieval cities, nice landscapes, beautiful flowers. And then you can learn things there. And so what I learned there, and good food, of course, good food. France, right? And then you can learn how to park your car. Right, so you'd really, that's how you park a car in France. You squeeze it in. I drew the line at learning how to jump to avoid bulls or to jump over them. I did not do that. Okay. But what I did do, I worked at the Centre d'Ecologie Fonctionnelle Evolutive in Montpellier, which is a large research center funded by the CNRS. CNRS is the equivalent of NSF. The difference being that in France, the CNRS funds their own research institutes, whereas NSF doesn't do that. And this Center for Ecological Research has 100 scientists. It's a good place to go. At some point, there were 6 American professors at the same time visiting while I was there. So clearly, it's a place which makes sense to go when you want to interact with colleagues. A bunch of people I know there, of course. They were very welcoming. So when I spent the year in the institute, my office was there on the third floor there. Okay. So where do we start? Well, where are the ideas that we know what to thinking about interspecific competition? And you will get a number of slides with some text where I cite things. That way I do justice to what people say and think. And so in 1989, there was a really interesting volume which was published by the British Ecological Society, which was called Ecological Concepts. And there were a bunch of chapters clearly about different things. And the chapter on competition, which was written by Lauren Watkinson, said that it was difficult to perceive a real sense of progress in our understanding of the role of competition in nature, 1989. And then they say that, you know, we can't really say that people have done anything useful in the past. You cannot point to an accretion of knowledge, to empirical questions clearly framed and unequivocally answered. Rather, we are left with an impression of a subject moving from one worldview to another, depending on the influence of the prevailing protagonist. What's really interesting for competition, but for science in general, that individual scientists can have an enormous influence over what people are allowed to think. And actually, and I give some illustration of that in the book when I review the ideas about competition in my first chapter. And what are the two ideas about competition? Either it's important or it's not important. So it's the important Keddie in his books on competition. It's a force as fundamental to ecosystems as the gravity is to planetary systems. That's pretty important. And then the other opinion really is, okay, it may be important, but until proven, we don't believe it exists as such. And proven by field experiments. Okay. So that's Keddie's book. The second edition was interesting. I have them on my desk, those two books. The first edition, which is 200 pages. The second edition is 550 pages. So he felt inspired. And he defines, and I like actually his definition of interspecific competition, which is basically the negative effects which one organism has upon another by consuming or controlling access to a resource that is limited in availability. Controlling means interactive. There is a behavioral component to the interaction. Consuming basically means if species A eats something which is in limited availability, it's not available for species B. Okay, so when on the one hand, Keddie is completely convinced that competition is absolutely essential and fundamentally important in ecosystems, a suite of critical people, which included Underwood from Australia, John Weens, and Nelson Haston, which is Nelson's father, one of my heroes in science, Nelson Haston Sr., wrote critical reviews about the evidence supporting the existence and the importance of interspecific competition. And you know, the type of criticism they give is not exhaustive here, but is some of them I listed here. Is first one, circumstantial evidence from descriptive data cannot be used to exclude alternative hypotheses. What does this mean? If two species have allopatric distributions, this can be because they compete with one another and therefore cannot coexist, or they can simply be because they are two different species that evolve separately. You cannot exclude one or the other hypothesis. So you can't use it as evidence that competition is important. The second argument is that competition may have been important, but no longer is important, no longer plays a role. The third criticism, which I think was valid in those days, was that very few field experiments to test for the existence of interspecific competition were done properly. They didn't have controls, they didn't have replicates. And they usually went on for a week or two, sometimes for a month or two, but rarely for very long. So very few field experiments were done properly. And then the fourth criticism was interesting, is that the species that were selected to test the existence of interspecific competition experimentally were a biased subset. And it's true, if you look in Wiens' book, 1989, he lists the experiments competition which existed then. Three quarters are using cavity nesting birds. Why? Cavity nesting birds, in many cases, they use nest boxes, and you can play around with nest boxes and do things. And it's not because competition is important, perhaps, in cavity nesting birds, that this is generally important in nature. So the species selected is a biased subset. Okay, so competition. Okay, thank you. Competition occurs when resources are limiting, and this limitation has an effect on fitness or abundance. The question is, can we observe it, and can we prove it exists experimentally? And the large team which is recurring in my book is the use and the need for field experiments to be done properly. Okay, now that's an interesting problem with competition, because if you look at predator-prey interactions, or herbivores, or parasites, I mean, you just observe that it happens, right? There's no discussion. You don't have to prove that predation exists. You can observe it. You don't have to prove that the mosquito is taking blood from the bird. You just observe it. Even for mutualistic interactions, you can often observe that it exists. So you can ask different questions. You don't ask the question, does predation occur? You can ask the question, what's the effect of predation on the host, on the predator, etc., etc. And the problem with competition is that although you can observe aggression, this doesn't mean that competition is taking place, right? Now, in this case, this is an example of aggression of a fight between two woodpeckers, and you see this flicker here is holding on to the tip of the tongue, this poor red-bellied woodpecker. In this case, it is linked to competition because they are fighting over a hole in which to breed, and there is only one hole and there's two birds. So in this case, the flicker, who's the more aggressive species, will exclude the red-bellied woodpecker from the cavity, and the red-bellied woodpecker will not be able to breed, so there's an effect on fitness. So this would be an example of interspecific competition. But it is rare that you can observe this so easily. So there's now a big paradox, and I will have four or five slides about this to make the point really clear. The paradox of interspecific competition is that it is so important that you can't observe it. And the reason you can't observe it, that is so important, that as soon as it exists, the species will evolve to avoid it. They will either go and live in different places or use different resources. So it is transient. And that's a point which has been made many, many times. I'm very fortunate to be at Cornell and have Mann Library. And in Mann Library, we have the book by Gauss from 1934. And I remember when I started in the 2001, started preparing, thinking about my book, I came to the library and borrowed Gauss's book. And I held this book in my hand. I said, oh God, it was unbelievable. I must say, when I used it again the 6 years later, I could just read it online. It completely scanned the whole thing. It was kind of convenient, actually. Anyway, but we have this book here. And Gauss is one of the people who played a fundamental role in the development of ideas around interspecific competition. He's also the guy who did the first experiments, which you find in all the textbooks of ecology, which we teach every year in introductory ecology classes, the experiments which Gauss performed. And the experiments were to test mathematical models, which had been developed in the 1927, 1928 by Lothar and Volterra, a couple of Italian scientists. But what's interesting about Gauss's idea that he formulates here is that if two species that as a result of competition, two species that are similar do not use the same resources, basically. And he gives this real nice example from the, from some terns that some Russian colleague of his studied, and said that although you would believe when you look at them, they eat the same thing, when you look more closely, you discover they eat different things. They use different resources. So the systematic, the intensity of competition is determined not by the likeness, the closely, the relatedness of the species, but by the similarity of the resource they use. And this has been reformulated as the principle of competitive exclusion, Gauss's principle that we all use in all the textbooks of ecology, always come back to Gauss's idea. Okay. It's interesting that Gauss never formulated the principle of competitive exclusion the way we use it today. That's actually as close as we come to this formulation. Okay. So the paradox of competition is that the evidence that we use to prove the existence of competition is indirect. It's indirect because competition is transient when it occurs, and the species will evolve to avoid competing further. The result of that, if that is true, you cannot test the existence of interspecies competition experimentally. Because today, when we observe nature, the species that coexist do not compete. If this hypothesis, this assumption is true. And to show you how many important people believe this is true, I give you a couple of quotes. And many of you have met E.O. Wilson. This one, he was a bit younger, with Bill Brown. And so they wrote a review on character displacement, which is an effect of interspecies competition. And I like this quote because it's the way it is written is so different the way we would write today. He said, interspecific competition of the direct, conspicuous, unequivocal kind is apparently a relatively evanescent stage in the relationship of animal individuals or species. And therefore, it is difficult to catch and record. What we usually see is the result of the competitive contact. That's Brown and Wilson, David Lack, 1971, published a book, and David Lack was the leading ornithologist, ecologist in Europe, definitely, possibly in the world in those days. He wrote multiple books. In this book, Ecological Isolation in Birds, in chapter after chapter, for every family of birds, he describes how the species can coexist without competing. And actually, this illustration here by Robert Gilmore illustrates the work which David Lack did in Oxford in Whiteham Woods, and makes the point that although several species of tits coexist in the forest, they use different resources because they forage in different locations. The blue tit hangs upside down from the foliage and thin twigs. The gray tit forages mostly, not only on the ground, and the marsh tit sits somewhere in the middle. Of course, the simplification, but this illustrates Lack's idea. This is how it is possible that those species coexist in the same forest, although at first glance they use the same resources. And Chris Perrins, when he wrote a book on tits in 79, explained how this comes about. Over long periods of time, natural selection has favored those individuals that have evolved ways such to be different from the others. 1979. So the idea that the competition does not exist, cannot be observed, is something which is still relatively recent. Okay. So how did I do this? Then how do I handle this? I said, okay, let me, after reading the literature, I said, let me set up a number of necessary conditions and a number of sufficient conditions relative to interspecific competition. If any of the three necessary conditions does not occur, we do not need to discuss the possible existence of interspecies competition because those, they have to exist. And what are those three conditions? Well, first, one or more resources are limiting. If resources are not limiting, there cannot be competition. Intraspecific competition occurs, meaning there is competition between individuals of the same species for limiting resources. In the older formulation, when I was a grad student, we looked at density dependence and population regulation, which is the same thing with different words. And then clearly, for interspecific competition to exist, resource use of potential competitors must overlap. If the two different species do not use the same resources, there will not be competition. And then sufficient conditions are basically evidence for the existence of competition, namely that if resource use by one species affects the availability for another species, so if species A eats the food, it's not available for species B. And then a stronger evidence for the existence of industry competition is the effect of fitness, so the effect of competition. If the density of one species increases, the fitness of the other species will decline. And then finally, perhaps the strongest evidence is that the presence of a species affects the distribution and or abundance of the other species. So, and I structured my book around those six ideas, basically. So in chapters 3, 4, and 5, I look at the resources which are potentially limiting, which is food, space, and nest sites. And I look at the evidence in the literature that exists that shows when people ask the question, is the limitation of space, is space limiting? Have people have done experiments to test this? I report that. And the answer is yes. We find a lot of examples where there is competition either for space, for food, and or for nest sites. What's interesting about the nest site one is that when you look, the nest sites are also limiting for open nesting species. Because normally we always think nest sites are limiting only for cavity nesting species, although some people believe actually cavity nesting species are not limited, but that's okay. But Tom Schoener did beautiful experiments where he proved that open nesting species, that the nest site for an open nester actually is a very valuable resource and that it's limiting. And that, you know, that some species cannot use the best nest site because of competition with a different species. That's something which I think deserves more study. Okay, can we document intra-specific competition? The answer is yes, of course, I would say, but you know, the question is for which of the population processes. And what's interesting when you review this exhaustively is that even if it's within a single group of animals, birds, you find that depending on the life history of the species, the population processes which are affected by intra-specific condition are not the same. Long-lived species do not typically have effects, density-dependent effects on reproduction, but they have density-dependent effects on dispersal. Short-lived species often have density-dependent effects on reproduction and or perhaps on mortality. And actually what I do in that chapter is that I review a number of species for which that have been studied for the entire year, and all those processes have been looked at to see which one of those processes are the ones which are most affected by intra-specific competition. And that's something, you know, which I think deserves to be done more systematically than I did myself, you know, just to frame that chapter, which maybe I might do one day, is to do an exhaustive review of literature to see for different life history strategy of a species which of the population processes are most affected by intra-specific competition. The problem is that there are very few studies of animals where we study them year round. And like, you know, and there is like one of the studies that I summarize is by Dick Holmes, and this is a black-throated blue warbler, where he studies the effects of competition both in the breeding grounds in New Hampshire and the winter grounds in Jamaica. And he finds effects, different effects on different components of life history at different parts of the animal cycle. So yes, so that's chapter 6, then chapter 7. Okay. Now that's the food, and the reason this chapter food comes here is that enormous amount of work has been done where people have asked the question, but foraging niches, when a species is by itself or with a potential competitor, does it look for food at the same locations? And I combine there the foraging niche, the direct evidence, and also there's a lot of observational data there which are very interesting. What's very interesting when I read that at some point was a Douglas Moss, some of you might know him. He used to work on birds. He looked at competition and foraging niches between birds. And so in his, he was a young guy in 1968, and he published a paper. He said, you know, the pygmy nuthatch is affected by the presence of difficult footwitch warbler as regards foraging. And quite strongly, he said, risk competition between the species. And then a couple of years later, he writes a paper, and he's much more careful how he phrases this. So I send him an email and say, Doug, what happened? What happened between 68 and 72? Why did you change your mind? Or why did you rephrase the certainty that you had to something much more careful? And he said, well, in those days, for a young scientist, I'm talking about the late 60s, the early 70s, for a young scientist, making the claim that interspecies competition was really important was dangerous for your career. Well, so that's a citation I have somewhere in my book also, that email. Kind of interesting to see that the power certain individuals have, you know, what you're allowed to think. Interesting. Okay. Then chapter 8 is a big chapter. I review exhaustively all the field experiments which have been done on interspecific competition involving birds, some of which involve birds and insects, or birds and fish, or birds and mammals, but always birds were always involved. And then chapter 9, I summarize my own field experiments on competition between great and blue tit in Belgium. We've got chapter 8, and I summarize briefly. So there is about 100 field experiments have been done that I discussed, that I found. I probably missed a few, but I don't think I missed too many. Today, with the web of science and the way you can search literature, it's pretty amazing. And my students know that I tell them, you should do your homework, and I can't allow you to miss literature. You have to read your stuff. And find it, and read it, and remember it. That's the important part. Okay. So it's about 100, and I've split them here in this summarizing table, in those where experiments where either numbers or resources were manipulated. 75. And you see that most of them, but not all of them, show that there is interspecific competition between the species. In 9 experiments, there was no evidence for competition at all. And in 13, there was evidence for facilitation. One of the interesting things which has happened in the early 90s was by a Finnish colleague and friend, Mikko Mikkonen, who did a fascinating experiment. He, in northern Finland, he had some islands, and in some of the islands he added nest boxes to increase the number of tits that were there in winter. In other islands he removed the birds. And then he watched where the migrants would arrive. And the migrant birds, and if there was competition, the migrant birds should go on the islands where the tits had been removed. But he didn't find that. He found the birds settled where the tits were present, rather than where the tits had been removed. And he called this heterospecific attraction. And the idea, the logic here is that migrants which breed in the far north don't have much time to make a decision where they will breed. They arrive, they have to start nesting almost immediately. So, what information do they use? Where do the birds that stayed spent with here live? Where do the birds survive? There must be good conditions there, therefore let me settle there also. And Mikko and his colleagues have done a whole suite of experiments showing that facilitation occurs over and over again. It is more complicated, more interesting than that, but that's the basic idea. The second row here is playback experiments where you to test for the existence, if one species, two species co-occur, you play the song of one species, will the other species respond yes or no? And the answer is often but not always. See, that's, you know, often but not always. And that's actually something which deserves to be looked at also in more detail. There have not been done too many experiments, and especially not in tropical areas or in mountain ranges. Okay. One of the things which clearly we're all interested in is the effects of climate change on what happens in nature. And so one of the things I didn't mean I had those long-term data from the tits in Belgium, and in 1977 I published a paper where I drew, this is a bit technical, but you know, just believe me, but the bottom line is correct, I drew isoclines, plot greater density and blue density get to one another. Each point is the number of great tits and blue tits in the same site in a particular year. And you can calculate isoclines through those points, and the way those isoclines intersect, tell you if competition will have an effect that the species can coexist or not. And fortunately, we know that gray tits and blue tits coexist. Fortunately, isoclines show that they do actually coexist. That was lucky. Okay, so that's 1977. We've continued the studies on tits. They're still ongoing, actually, in Antwerp. And then in just after 2000, a bunch of us decided we should put all the data on tit mice from Europe together. And from 1880 to 2000, we had study sites in England, Belgium, the Netherlands, France, Finland, Germany, Corsica, and Russia. And we analyzed, and we had data for 14 study sites for great and blue tit, and we looked to see if there was an effect on laying dates because of changing climate. And their answer was yes, but not always. There again, I'm not going into the details. I can explain that if you're interested. So we found that there are effects of climate change on at least laying date and clutch initiation date. And also we found since then that actually on the whole nesting cycle behavior has changed to some extent by several days actually on top of the lay date linked to climate change. So then we thought, well, maybe this could have an effect on the outcome of interspecific competition too. And so Niels Stenseth, a colleague of mine in Oslo, said, okay, give me your data. I will have somebody play with them. Actually, by now it's about 7 different mathematicians have played with them. And they've produced some interesting equations, which we're not going to discuss. But basically, that is the data. This is one study site in Belgium over a period of 45 years. And you see the red points are great tits. The blue line is blue tits. And you can see over the period of 45 years, great tit numbers have gradually increased, although they fluctuate from year to year. Blue tit numbers have decreased. We know there's competition with two species. Does competition play a role in this change in abundance of the two species? So what Niels Christian did, he calculated the isoclines, which as you can see look very similar to the ones I calculated in 1977. And the isoclines still say that the two species coexist in a stable fashion. And those are the equations which he calculated. And then what he did, he looked at spring temperature and April temperature. And so for part of the period, and this turned out to be the critical temperature for the April temperature, 8.6 degrees centigrade, if the temperature in April is warmer, the model to calculate coexistence changes, and the isoclines change in such a way that blue tits barely survive. So the prediction of this model is that because of temperature change in April, the coexistence of gray tit and blue tit is endangered, and blue tits might go extinct in a closed system. At this moment, they're not going extinct, but they might go if those things continue and become worse. So the intensity of competition can change with changing environments. And in the book, I list a number of examples in plants and other animals that show effects of climate change on coexistence, on the intensity of competition, which can become worse, can become better. One interesting reference which I found was about 40,000 years ago. You may remember, it was a bit colder then. And the paper that says that because of this cold spell 40,000 years ago, through the existence of interspecific competition between modern man and Neanderthal man went extinct. So that's what competition can do. Okay. So we have shown that competition does exist. The conditions are fulfilled. The evidence is there. So now the next question that I want to address is, can the existence of industry competition cause an evolutionary change? Clearly, to show that experimentally, one needs long-term data. And so, and to me, to some extent, this is, we're coming back full circle, whereas on the one hand, 50 years ago, people said, species that coexist do not compete because they compete in the past and have become different, implying that because of competition, this caused evolutionary change. I find that there is compelling evidence that competition does exist, is ongoing. Therefore, you would expect an evolutionary change in certain populations in certain conditions. And clearly, where we go first, So can we identify selection pressures? How rapidly does it go? And typically, we go first to where? To the Galapagos Islands, be the Grant, Peter and Rosemary Grant's work. And this is a particularly interesting example. It's not experimental, but close enough. So what does this show? This shows you beak size of the medium ground finch. And this is time. And what you see is that here in 1977, there was a very severe drought in the El Niño effect, in the Niña effect. And the majority of the individuals on the island, on Daphne Island, died. And only the large-beaked birds survived, with the exception of three small-beaked females also, but it's okay. So here there was a severe, an extremely rapid evolutionary change caused by a lack of food and intra-specific competition, competition between species, individuals of the same species. Okay, over time, they had several recurrent events like that. And around here, a second Darwin's finch settled on the island, Magnirostris, the large-beaked ground finch. And for a while, nothing happened. The medium ground finch, the big size didn't really change. And here they had, again, an extreme drought, actually 2 years in a row, where a large number of the Darwin's finches, the medium finches, died because of lack of food, competition. But in this note, it was not only competition with individuals of the same species, it was also competition with individuals of a different species. And in this case, a different species had a much larger beak. So the Magnirostris was able to eat the remaining large seeds, which were there, therefore having them no longer available for the medium-sized finch, and only the medium-sized finch with small beaks could survive. And we had here the opposite effect as regards competition here. This was caused by intraspecific competition. This was caused by interspecific competition. So that suggests that interspecific competition can cause evolution change very rapidly. Depending how you calculate, it's either over 20 years or over 2 years, but it's very rapid regardless. When I started my experiments on tits in Belgium, one of my objectives was to manipulate densities of the two species and to see if this would result in evolutionary change in the birds. And I give you one example for the blue tit. This is tarsus length, that's the length of the leg. This is three study sites. And what I did is here, so there was a 15-year experiment, and what I did between 88 and 1989, I changed the density and therefore the intensity of interspecific competition in this one plot in plot T, whereby I did not change anything in the two other plots. And what happened is that in the situation, this five-year period in which the intensity of intra and interspecific competition was really high, there was a selection for larger blue tits, larger individuals. Whereas in the other two sites, nothing really changed. So also, this is a very rapid evolutionary change. When you change, clearly this is artificial. It is playing around with nest boxes and manipulating densities. But it's a field experiment. You don't control anything else. And there also, you see that a rapid evolutionary change can happen because of a change in the intensity of interspecific competition. So what do I conclude from writing this book? Well, interspecific competition happens today. We can observe it. It's ongoing. Not everywhere, not all the time, but it's ongoing. I will not go in detail, but there's no real bias regarding the taxa used. And as regards the quality of the field experiments, it is amazing how many really good field experiments have been done the last 10 or 20 years. It is unbelievable. It is either that the students are better trained, or that the bad experiments no longer get published, which is or both. But clearly, the quality of the field experiments in ecology has become phenomenal. I would say ecology has come of age, field ecology has come of age fully. I'm sure for botanists, I mean, this was already a long time ago. Then, ongoing interspecific competition can cause rapid evolutionary changes, and it is a generally important force that we must take into account when we evaluate community structure. Okay, now, hold on. Don't go away yet. This is the start of the talk. So here we go. You write the book manuscript, I said, and now can I find a publisher? So I know that we knew that Princeton University Press no longer was interested. They do not books like that. And you know, I did find it published because the book is here. But how did this happen? Well, I contacted Oxford University Press and I said, you have this really nice series, the Ecology Evolution series. Might be interesting to put my book in there. And actually, I talked to several of the other editors of the series. And they said, well, you know, yes, maybe, you know, and if you want to do this, you have to do this and that and the other, which I did actually. And then 6 years later, I went back to Oxford to say, okay, now I have manuscript almost finished. Are you still interested? They said, well, not for that series, because it's only when I commissioned those books that we published about that series. But we have a new series, Oxford Avian Biology. Maybe it would fit in there. So what happens then, the publisher gives you a questionnaire, and you have to write a prospectus, which explains, you know, what the book is about, why anybody should care about this book, what other books exist in the field which are similar, and therefore would compete. This time, that's an important concept here. And then, you know, and then what is the structure of the book, and can you write half a page about each chapter, etc., etc. You send this prospectus to the publisher, and the publisher sends it out to a number of reviewers. Now, two things which have... So the first reviewer said, you know, question five is, do you recommend publishing this book? The publisher said, not really. Kind of, you know, when I read this, I said, interesting. The book is somewhat dated. Top composition, you know, is no longer interested in ecology. Although Don't is okay to write this book, it's about 20 years too late. Okay. Fortunately, the three other reviewers said, yes, you should do this book. And this is some nice things and why this book should be done. So when I received those comments from the reviewers, I'm in Oslo at a meeting for Niels Stenseth, who had his 60th birthday, and to have a feast for his 60th birthday, he invited a number of his colleagues with whom he had collaborated for a three-day symposium, which was a phenomenal symposium. And then it ended then with a dinner, and I can guarantee you it is true, Norwegians gave speeches which never end. The dinner was finished at 3 o'clock in the morning. Only three or four speeches, so that's it. Anyway, so I read those comments in my hotel, I go to the symposium, and between two talks, I sit next to Peter Grad. I say, Peter, I just received the comments from the reviewers. One is really bad, but the three others are good, and one is really, really useful. The reviewer gives me useful, really helpful advice how to change certain things in the book. He looks at me and says, yeah, this was me. So I said, well, thank you. I'm glad I said it was helpful, rather. Okay. So the book gets published, and then, you know, then you wait. What will people say about your book? Of course, you know, I can say all the nice things about my book here because, you know, nobody, well, you can talk back to me in a moment. But, you know, but then you wait to see what reviewers write. And today, there's actually two reviews have appeared in April, one in Trends of Ecology and Evolution, and I would say I couldn't have written it myself. It was real nice. And what's interesting, the point she makes, and actually I don't know this lady, I'm good enough, I don't really know her, but you know, when I meet her, I will say thank you. The point she makes is that, you know, it is more than just for ornithology, which clearly was the objective of writing the book. I mean, I'm an ornithologist, yes, but I'm an ecologist, a population ecologist, a behavior ecologist, you know, an evolution ecologist. I'm all of the above. I'm interested in birds. I know more about birds than most other groups of organisms. But when you do something in the science, you want it to be more generally useful rather than more specifically. So the fact that she says that the book is more than just an ornithology resource is kind of nice. So I think that objective was attained. And then 2 days ago, I got this comment from Ken Otter from the University of Northern British Columbia, where he says it's a good book also. So he liked it too. So having said that, I will stop. I will, if you have any questions, I may be able to answer them. Thank you.
This has been a production of Cornell University, on the web at cornell.edu.